Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Stewart International Airport is facing declining passenger numbers and currently has just two airlines operating there. Now, Orange County officials are backing a new financial incentive designed to change that. We'll look at a proposed revenue guarantee program aimed at reducing risk for carriers considering new routes to Stewart, whether that could help reverse the airport's recent struggles. When school cafeterias close for the summer, hundreds of local children can lose access to regular meals. We'll learn how the regional food bank will help by delivering food directly to families. Pike County is increasing its transit fares. We'll tell you why. Beyond Plastics founder Judith Enck joins us. And award-winning journalist and Sullivan County native Justine Vanderluen opens this year's literary festival. We'll chat with her after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Israel and Hezbollah have agreed to a ceasefire. That's according to a senior U.S. official who declined to be identified. The conflict in southern Lebanon became a major sticking point in peace talks between the U.S. and Iran, with Tehran insisting that any broader agreement address the violence there. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports negotiations between the U.S. and Iran in Switzerland were called off today after the two sides had announced a preliminary agreement this week.
Here we are in Switzerland waiting for a peace deal. Across this beautiful alpine lake from me here in Lucerne, the Swiss government has taken a range of security measures to host this event, and there are hundreds of journalists here to record it. But for now, Iran's foreign ministry said the signing ceremony is off. The White House said in a statement that the plans for the upcoming technical talks have not been finalized. And either side is here. They're threatening to strike each other, and this agreement appears to be on very shaky ground.
It's NPR's Rob Schmitz reporting from Lucerne. The Barack Obama Presidential Center opens to the public in Chicago today. NPR's Tamara Keith reports the 19-acre campus is expected to draw visitors from around the world.
I got a chance to visit the center and walk through it earlier this month, and it really does, like that concert event, capture the vibes of the Obama years as if the past decade never happened. But Obama said he doesn't see it as a time capsule.
The exhibits in the center are not meant to evoke nostalgia for some gauzy bygone era, some unattainable past that we can dream about and say, oh, we miss you, Barack.
He said he wants to remind visitors of what's possible.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting from Chicago. The first flu vaccine that uses the same technology as the COVID-19 shots has taken an important step toward possible approval. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
A flu vaccine that uses mRNA technology won the endorsement of a key Food and Drug Administration advisory committee after a day-long meeting. The FDA's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee voted unanimously that the benefits of the mRNA flu vaccine appear to outweigh any risks for adults age 50 and older. The fate of the vaccine is being closely watched because mRNA technology has been both glorified and vilified in the wake of the pandemic. The FDA usually follows the advice of its advisory committees, but Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been a vocal critic of vaccines, especially mRNA vaccines. Rob Stein, NPR News.
This is NPR. An investigation into two baby giraffes who went missing for more than a year has ended on a happy note. They were found safe. NPR's Amy Held reports the owners of a Virginia zoo, though, are facing animal cruelty charges.
At 6 feet tall and well over 100 pounds, newborn giraffes stand out. Still, two vanished in April 2025 from Virginia's Natural Bridge Zoo. The state attorney general's office said this week they found them. They did not say where. The zoo's owners and staff had been charged with animal cruelty, accused of abusing dozens of animals, underfeeding and crowding them, which they deny. Worldwide, more than a half million animals are held at unaccredited wildlife attractions. A new Virginia state law aims to protect those animals. Inspired by the baby giraffes, the law bans early separation from mothers. These as yet unnamed young giraffes have a new home at a conservation park in Georgia. Their mothers are there too. Amy Held, NPR News.
Elizabeth Arnold, an award-winning NPR correspondent who covered presidential politics, Congress, and the environment, has died. Arnold began her journalism career in Bethel, Alaska, before moving to Washington to cover presidential campaigns and other national stories for NPR. She later returned to Alaska, where she taught journalism. An avid fisherwoman, runner, and Harley Davidson rider, Arnold maintained deep ties to the state throughout her life. Her family says she died from complications of cancer. Elizabeth Arnold was 66 years old. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Paramount Plus with The Agency, a political espionage thriller starring Michael Fassbender, Jeffrey Wright, Jodie Turner-Smith, and Richard Gere. All episodes of The Agency streaming June 21st on Paramount Plus. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Dan Hoost, who normally appears with us from Sullivan County Government, is at the Sullivan County Juneteenth celebration at the Government Center. We'll be back next week. Meanwhile, Orange County officials are supporting a new incentive program aimed at attracting additional airline service to Stewart International Airport by reducing the financial risk for carriers willing to launch new routes. Stewart is facing falling passenger numbers, and only two airlines serve the airport currently. Jason Dole spoke to Lana Bellamy, news editor with the Times Union, who says local leaders view the proposal as another opportunity to strengthen service at the airport, which is owned and operated by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey.
Orange County and the Port Authority, which owns the airport, they're constantly trying to pursue new efforts to try to get more business going at Stewart Airport. They're looking at this initiative that is called a minimum revenue guarantee. What it's supposed to do is sort of reduce the financial risk of any airlines that would want to begin service at the airport, and it would be funded through the Hudson Valley Economic Development Corporation, which is just a public-private partnership that helps businesses if they're going to relocate or expand in the Hudson Valley. And they needed to fund this initiative because the FAA doesn't allow the airport's owners to directly pay revenue to airlines.
What are local officials saying about this?
Well, local officials are very excited about it. Steve Newhouse thinks this is going to be something that can be really helpful, and that's why he does want the county to commit money to helping it work. State Senator James Skoufis also said that, you know, he hopes that the state can also help contribute funding, but that's not going to be something that we'll know until next year's budget. So people are very supportive of it overall. And they usually are of these initiatives at Stewart Airport because everyone wants it to succeed. I remember as a reporter, I wrote a story about Stewart Airport, I think it was in 2024, 2025, when Congressman Pat Ryan came to the airport and they were talking about all of the investing in infrastructure that officials on every level have taken part in trying to make things work for this airport. So I don't think anyone really wants to be critical of another new method of trying to lure airlines there at this point.
So now what's going to happen?
Well, right now, the Port Authority is pitching this initiative to airlines as we speak. It's still a little bit in the works as far as the mechanics of it. The state has promised to help contribute some funding to. The county has also promised some funding. So it's still going to be a group effort, but it really has to be led by the Hudson Valley Economic Development Corporation. And, you know, since it's already being offered, I think we'll be able to tell relatively soon if it has piqued any airlines' interest.
Great. And anything else you'll be watching for?
I will be watching for, if it does attract airlines, like how much this needs to be used. I've wondered if it's like a little bit of a chicken and an egg problem with Stewart Airport. if you have the airlines there, will it bring more people? I used to fly out of Stewart whenever I would go back home to my hometown in Kentucky. I would take a connecting flight to Philadelphia, and then I'd fly into Lexington. And it was really convenient because I lived in the Middletown area at the time. Didn't want to have to go to the city or Newark or Albany. And I think that I'm not alone in that in the Hudson Valley, that people would like to see this as an option. But the problem is that there's not a ton of options within the airport itself. And I think it's also worth noting, too, that but the way it works is if an airline fails to generate sufficient revenue during some agreed-upon timeline, which will be usually between the first 18 to 24 months of service, that's when they can apply for these funds to help reach that guaranteed minimum. So that's why it's also going to be interesting to see if it's, you know, needed or necessary or not.
It's Alana Bellamy of the Times Union speaking to our own Jason Dole. Now, for many children, the end of the school year also means the loss of a reliable source of breakfast and lunch. To help bridge that gap, the Regional Food Bank is launching a student summer meal kit program that will provide weekly meal packages to more than 600 children across 18 school districts in 9 counties. The USDA-funded initiative is designed to help families in rural communities where transportation challenges and higher food costs can make it difficult to access summer meal programs. Joining us now is Barry Lewis, Chief Communications Officer for the Regional Food Bank. Barry, thanks for joining us. Barry, did we lose you? Nope, I think we lost Barry. We're going to take a quick break and get him back on the line. This is Radio Chatskill.
If you face workplace discrimination, you can blow the whistle to an independent agency. But if you work for the federal courts, you don't have the same rights.
They have nowhere to turn, no independent enforcer, no neutral decision maker.
I'm Elsa Chang. Law students are asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on how the courts police themselves. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
It's the summertime. In the summertime, there are a lot of folk festivals. You can go to workshops, or you can see some of the best of the touring singer-songwriters and folk artists in our country. On the next Folk Plus, I will be playing live cuts from various folk festivals, and I hope you'll join me, and perhaps you'll even get to a festival yourself this summer. That's on Folk Plus, Sunday at 2, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Maybe a little trouble reaching Barry Lewis. We'll try him again. In the meantime, Pike County Transportation is working to expand access to public transit for as many Northeast Pennsylvanians as possible. Riders must still schedule pickup appointments, but the agency says it's working to upgrade its systems. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Pike County Transportation Director Robert Ruiz about available transit options and the planned fare increases.
So we have 4 main programs that our department have for reimbursement from the state. So one of them is the Shared Ride Program, which is for seniors 65 and older that offer discounted rides to travel to Pike County seniors. And that can be anywhere that they would want to go in county. And then we also have some days out of county that seniors are able to use as well. Then we have our medical assistance program, which is also known as MATP, which is funded through the Department of Human Services of Pennsylvania. And it is a free medical ride for medical assistant members. So if you have medical assistance through Pennsylvania and you have a medical appointment and you qualify through your medical assistance, you are eligible for free medical rides. And that is to and from doctor's offices and pharmacies. Then we have people with disabilities, and that is for ages 18 to 64, and that offers reduced fare shared rides for residents with disabilities. And you can go anywhere you would want in the county and out of county for uncertain days for any sort of purpose whatsoever. And then you have our general public, which is open to the entire public, which is not subsidized, which might be a little bit expensive for some county residents. But if you really need a ride and you don't qualify into those other funding buckets, then that would be a good option for you.
And do you have a sense as to what ridership typically looks like? How many people are kind of accessing these services annually?
Sure. So in the 2025 year, we provided about 30,000 rides for the entire community on the shared ride program for all across all of our programs. But the most popular program would be our senior shared ride program, which contribute to about 17,000 rides per the year of 2005.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. I think, you know, oftentimes people think that rural communities don't even have public transportation, or and so it's pretty incredible to hear that 30,000 number.
It is. And we are a shared ride program, which means, or paratransit, which means that we don't have mass transit. We don't have those big buses that you see in the city or in Monroe County, for example, our neighboring county. We have our smaller vehicles that are door-to-door service. So that's what our paratransit really is. So it's really personal service. And so all of our drivers really know our riders very well, and sometimes know them so well that they get concerned when they don't see them. So it's a really personal service and something I'm really proud of.
Yeah. And, you know, Pike County is kind of uniquely situated at this intersection of several states, obviously Pennsylvania, but then also New Jersey and then New York. Talk to me a little bit about how have you designed your transit routes to serve across state borders?
Yeah, so not only are we uniquely situated in a tri-state area where we can make a left and be in New Jersey or make a right and be in New York, but we also don't have a medical facility that is a hospital in our county. So because of that, we've really had to look at our resources and make sure that our individuals, which mostly use our vehicles and our services for medical appointments and medical access to important appointments to doctors and specialists. So we had to make sure that we are able to go to Goshen, Middletown, Sparta, Newton, Wayne County, Lackawanna County as well, because that's where the doctors are. So we've had to really make sure that we have enough resources and also make sure that we are using them correctly to get people to where they need to get to for those important appointments.
I want to talk a little bit also about what you might be hearing from folks who do use the service on a regular or semi-regular basis. Curious what you're hearing in terms of feedback about the public transit options that you offer.
Well, I get mixed messages all the time, and I think it's normal to receive that. So I hear that they love the service, they love the drivers, they absolutely have no complaints, some individuals. And then some individuals, obviously, we can't meet every need of the community all the time. And one of the things I'm working on is expanding our services as well into later in the evening and into weekend hours as well. However, that's been a challenge to find people who want to work those hours or can work those hours. And that is something that I am really trying to work on in the next year to ensure that we can meet those needs. I don't know what that looks like just yet, but it's definitely in the works.
And just as a reminder for folks, can you talk through what the current days and hours that Pike County Transportation does operate?
Absolutely. We operate 5 days a week from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Our office is staffed starting at 8 a.m., but the rides don't usually go out until about 7 in the morning. So depending on your appointment, just because our office isn't open doesn't mean our rides are not going on. They just happen early in the morning as well. So anytime, give us a call, 570-296-3408, and we'll be more than happy to assist you and walk you through any sort of situation or problem that you might have getting our ride in Pike County.
Let's talk a little bit about ride fares. I understand that fares will be increasing starting July 1st for Pike County Transportation. Obviously, fares vary based on how far you're going or what zone you're heading to. Can you talk me through what those fare increases will be and how it might vary depending on distance?
Sure. So we have We have put in an increase effective July 1st of 2026, a fare increase. This is our second one back-to-back. And we are doing a 15% increase depending on what funding bucket you fall into. So, for example, for seniors, you're going to see a smaller increase because actually our AAA, our Area on Aging, is picking up 50% of the cost to the senior. So you'll see an increase that is smaller versus the persons with disability that we'll see a bigger increase, unfortunately, because they're not allowed to have any sponsors. So you might see an increase there that's a little bit bigger in your pocket. Our smallest route, which would be in county from 0 to 16 miles, is $1.65 for a senior. And for persons with disability, it would be $3.25 in county. Now, let's take it to the extreme on the other side. For out of county, our biggest fare for 41 miles plus, you say it would be 41 miles anywhere out of county, would be for a senior $4.80. Where an out-of-county for a person with disability would be $9.55, the most.
And the fares could potentially vary quite significantly depending on maybe if you're out-of-county, how far you're traveling, if you're paying as a full fare resident. Mm-hmm. Why, you know, can you talk to me about just why such a large fare gap, I guess, depending on the individual and distance?
Sure. So the full fare amount is the most expensive amount, and that is because that is the cost that it is to deliver that service for that individual. So we take a lot into consideration. It would be fuel, expense on administration and driver fare and everything else as well. So the fares vary depending on the sponsorship. So the seniors are able to get a reduced fare because they have a sponsor of the PennDOT program, and also our local area on aging is picking up 50% of their copay as well. And that is allowed through that program. However, persons with disabilities are not allowed to have a sponsorship, only have the PennDOT program available to them. So they have a reduced sponsorship, but it's not as reduced as the seniors, unfortunately.
If folks are interested in finding more information on the various public transit options that you described, or were interested in making a reservation, can you share more information about where they should head to or who they should call?
Yeah, so please head to www.pikepa.org/PCT for Pike County Transportation. And there you'll go into our homepage, and you'll be able to see all of our services, our applications, and our contact information. And you are more than welcome to contact anybody at the office at 570-296-3408.
We've been chatting with Rob Ruiz, Pike County's Director of Transportation, about the Pike County Transit options that are available in the county. Rob, thank you again so much for chatting.
Thank you so much for having me, and I appreciate your time.
And now returning to that story about the Regional Food Bank launching their Student Summer Meal Kit program. It's going to provide weekly meal packages to more than 600 children across 18 school districts in 9 counties throughout the region. Joining us now is Barry Lewis, back on the line from the Regional Food Bank. Barry, thanks for joining us.
Very good to join you. Appreciate it, Tim.
It can be a difficult time for families who rely on school meals in the summer. Can you explain the food security challenges many children face once school lets out?
Well, that's the key, and it was funny. So the Regional Food Bank is going to be hosting next week on Wednesday at the George Ross McKenzie Elementary School in Glen Spey an announcement about our, as you said, Student Summer Meal Kit program. And I was talking with the superintendent, Tracy Ferreira, and she mentioned how last week when it was so hot, parents had contacted her and said, well, why don't we close the school because it's warm out inside the building. And her response was that she has more control over what kids are able to eat when they're in the building. And we forget that food insecurity is such a major problem in this area, and actually throughout the country, but, you know, particularly in parts of your listening area, that when it comes to weekends, when it comes to the summer, the generosity of New York State in terms of free breakfast and free lunch goes away. And what the food bank is trying to do is to make a greater effort to ensure that safety net of school breakfasts and lunches, when they're not available during the summer, we can offset that.
You mentioned you're announcing it officially next week, but this meal kit program will serve hundreds of children. How does it work? What
can families expect to receive?
So we work on this with referrals from the school districts, and it's a federally funded program by the USDA. And the criteria is that it must be a rural school district and that they have to meet, that the districts have to meet eligibility requirements in terms of low income families. And so we work with the school districts to see what is possible. And with that criteria, starting about the last week of June and going over 10 weeks, meal kits, breakfast and lunch, you know, they're going to be getting, kids are going to be getting everything from apple juice and milk. They'll get cereal, waffles. They're going to get lunches. They'll get chicken nuggets. They'll get fruit cocktail, crackers. You know, it's a 10 week of this. And each week they're going to get 7 breakfasts and 7 lunch delivered in a box. If for some folks who maybe get or participate in some of these box meal delivery programs, it's the same idea. It'll be UPS delivery, and they'll come to their homes.
And in our region, students in Eldred, Rockland, Sullivan West, and the Franklin in Sullivan County, and the Franklin Central School District in Delaware County will receive meal kits. And again, how did this become involved? Did these become involved because the folks reach out to you, or did you reach out to certain districts to make them fit into the program?
We reached out to the school districts to see who was compliant, who would want to take part in it, and those are the school districts. So, right in Sullivan County, it was Eldred, Rockland, and Sullivan West, and they fit the criteria. Now, while this is going on, separate and a part of the meal kit program, which again, this is in the second year. Last year, we were able to provide 400 students with these meals. This year, we're doing 600, and it's in 18 districts in 10 counties. So we're really looking to step up. But at the same time that we're going to be doing 600 with the meal kit program, we also are going to be continuing our summer backpack program, which will provide meals for another 2,000 students. And so between the two of them, we're hoping to, you know, between 2,600-2,700 meals for youngsters in the summer when they may not otherwise be getting food.
And your summer backpack program has been serving students for a few years now, I believe. There are going to be students in Fallsburg and Monticello school districts, as well as Marlborough, Highland Falls, and Orange County, and New Paltz in Ulster. Why is it important to offer these multiple approaches to addressing summer hunger rather than relying on a single program?
Well, I think as we found out during COVID that there are various ways to get food out to families and to youngsters, and we're trying to work out what are the various ways. And with the federal government stepping up with this, we're able to expand the funding and all the various programs. And the summer backpack program works like our school year backpack program. Food comes into our inventory, and it either gets picked up or delivered to these central delivery locations. And then it's picked up by our community partners. It's taken back to facilities where it's packed in bags for final distribution. And then the bags are either delivered to kids or picked up by the kids as part of the partners program for the summer. So it's various ways. It all depends on the school district. So this is the summer program. And as you mentioned, during the year we have our backpack program. And we're going to be beginning this fall. It'll be our 20th year of doing the backpacks. So I think we realize that as the need has increased, as food insecurity, you know, in Sullivan County, where we have a year-round population of about 77,000 people, more than 3,300 children are food insecure, 14% of the whole population, but about 33%, just 3,300 children alone. And when we say food insecure, it just means that they don't know where necessarily their next meal is coming from. You know, we work with a lot of agencies. We work with a lot of groups in Sullivan County, Sullivan 180, A Single Bite. We work with our community partners in churches and the pantries and, you know, Catholic Charities. so many organizations to be able to, you know, we set up the mobile pantries. We're going to be doing that in Livingston Manor next month, in Livingston Manor and in Roscoe, pop-up pantries, various ways to get food out to people in need.
When we spoke to Susan Lintner, the Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer for the Regional Food Bank a few weeks ago, we were talking about how soaring fuel prices were cutting into your ability to, you know, get food to families. Is that still a strain on the food bank being able to deliver food, even though, you know, those fuel prices have eased somewhat?
Yeah, well, we all know that the price of fuel has gone up. We know for those who are driving trucks how much diesel fuel, which is what our trucks use. So, yeah, it was an unexpected. In May, the Regional Food Bank spent an additional $10,000 just in the month of May. And we expect in June that's not going to go down much. This is money that we had not intended to spend. And that $10,000 translates to 30,000 meals that we would otherwise be able to provide. Now, we're not in any way looking to cut back, and we haven't cut back at all on what we're delivering. And as you can, you know, see, we're actually in many ways expanding. But in order to do so, and with the increase in gas prices, we're reaching out for even further donations, further help from the state and from folks in the community. And as they understand the impact, because they know within their own household what's going on, they're all stepping up. We saw the greatest increase in donations this past year when there was the shutdown and the USDA made great cuts. People realize, and if you talk to anybody who's running any of these food pantries that we have in Sullivan County, they'll tell you that they're seeing folks that they've never seen before, senior citizens on fixed incomes who are making decisions about purchasing, you know, will they do a complete purchase of all the medications they need, or can they go up with maybe half of that medication need so then they have enough money left over for food. It's hard to imagine that in this day and age and in this country that that's taking place, but it is.
For folks listening, where can they go to learn more about how to support the Regional Food Bank's efforts to ensure children and families have enough food to eat?
It's really easy. If they go to regionalfoodbank.net, regionalfoodbank.net, they'll go to our website. They can see how they can help. Any dollar amount, any donation, like I said, for every dollar we raise, we're able to provide three meals because we buy in such large quantities. They can figure it. They can see how they can volunteer if they want to their time. If they can't volunteer and make the trip out to our Orange County Distribution Center in Montgomery in Orange County, we have a list of food pantries that I know would love to have volunteers come out there. But, yeah, if they just go to regionalfoodbank.net, they can see how they can help. And their donations really make a big difference. And because of that, we're able to expand the programs that we have in the summer and year-round.
Barry Lewis with the Regional Food Bank. Barry, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate it.
Still to come, a conversation with the founder of Beyond Plastics. We'll talk about the growing concerns over microplastics and why recycling alone won't solve the problem. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. Early voting is happening now in New York State and goes through June 21st. All registered voters in Delaware County are eligible to cast an early vote at the Board of Elections office on 97 Main Street in Delhi. Find your New York early voting polling place at elections.ny.gov. That's elections.ny.gov. Primary election day is June 23rd. This is Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Plastic is everywhere, wrapped around our food, woven into our clothing, and increasingly found in our bodies and the environment. But what if the plastics crisis is about far more than litter and recycling bins? This weekend at the Deepwater Literary Festival in Narrowsburg, environmental advocate and former EPA regional administrator Judith Enck joins award-winning investigative journalist Andrea Bernstein for a conversation titled No Future in Plastic. They're exploring how plastic became embedded in modern life and the public health and environmental consequences of its widespread use. The event is presented in collaboration with Damascus Citizens for Sustainability and is part of Deepwater's 2026 theme, Time Shift. Judith Enck is also the founder and president of Beyond Plastics and the author of The Problem with Plastic, How Can We Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late? And Judith Enck joins us now. Judith, welcome.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here and excited to visit Narrowsburg for the first time this Sunday. I'll be, as you noted, at the Deepwater Literary Festival at 1:30, talking about my book, and so honored to be interviewed by Andrea Bernstein. But earlier in the day, I will be at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Narrowsburg at 10:15, which is at 7 Erie Avenue. So it'll be nice to present to the Unitarians and then come to the Literary Festival afterwards.
And your new book, The Problem with Plastic, argues that plastic isn't just a waste issue, it's a public health issue. What are some of the health concerns that worry you the most?
Well, there are two major health concerns, and I'm glad we're having this conversation on Juneteenth because plastics is a major environmental justice problem because most of it is manufactured in Louisiana, Texas, Appalachia, and poisoning people that live near these manufacturing facilities. And then for those of us who don't live near those communities, plastics is a health threat because it's made from 16,000 different chemicals and ethane, which is a waste product from fracking. And in the last few, so there are climate change implications and toxics implications. And in the last few years, scientists have identified microplastics in different parts of the human body. And it's important to understand that there's the physicality of these little bits of plastic. Microplastics is 5 millimeters or less. And the toxic chemicals used to make the plastic hitchhike on the pieces of plastic that have been found in our lungs, our kidneys, our bloodstream, heart arteries. It has crossed the blood-brain barrier. Microplastics have been found in the human placenta, in breast milk, male testicles, and other parts of the body. So this is a pretty serious issue that does not get enough attention either from the medical community were elected officials.
One of your arguments is that consumers have been encouraged to blame themselves for the plastic crisis. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So in the 70s, the companies that manufacture plastic, and right now the number one manufacturer of plastic is that little mom and pop company, ExxonMobil. In the 70s, the plastics industry knew that they had a problem, and across the country, local laws were being proposed to, for instance, ban plastic bags or ban polystyrene foam packaging known as styrofoam. So they decided to launch a multi-million dollar deception advertising campaign, fooling people into thinking that we don't have to worry about all the plastics in our lives because we can recycle it. But they knew at the time, and we know today, that only 5 to 6% of plastics actually gets recycled. If you have an empty aluminum can, you can recycle that into a new aluminum can. A newspaper can be recycled into cardboard. But it doesn't work for plastics recycling because there are 16,000 different chemicals used to make plastic, all different types of plastics known as polymers, and different colors. So if you think of your own home or apartment, you might have a bright orange hard plastic detergent bottle near your washing machine, and then a thin film plastic bread bag in your kitchen. Those two things cannot be recycled together. Thus, the abysmal low recycling rate and really confusing a lot of people about the recyclability of plastics. So people should keep recycling other materials, but plastics recycling just isn't viable. So the solution and what we work for at Beyond Plastics is reducing the production, use, and disposal of plastics. Lots of good information on our website, beyondplastics.org.
And you've worked inside government, outside of government. What are the biggest obstacles policymakers face when trying to regulate plastic production?
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking. So I served during the Obama administration at the EPA and decided that if I wanted to work on plastics, I should do that on the outside as an educator, organizer, and advocate. Because often government needs to be kind of dragged along to work effectively on contemporary environmental issues. For instance, we're not doing very well on climate change. So I think the biggest problem with making progress on plastics is not a lack of information. It's not a lack of interest from the public. It's the sheer raw political power of the plastics industry. And that includes the fossil fuel companies, chemical companies, big consumer brand companies like Amazon. So for instance, we were very close to passing a comprehensive single-use packaging reduction bill in Albany this legislative session, but we just got outmaneuvered and outpowered by over 100 special interest lobbyists that roam the halls in Albany, and they prevailed rather than the public interest. So this is a political problem, not a science problem.
Here in the Catskills, the Upper Delaware region, Northeast Pennsylvania, residents care really deeply about clean water, healthy ecosystems, and outdoor recreation. But it sometimes seems that the scale of the problem is overwhelming. What are some actions that individuals can do to actually make a difference? And what are the actions that matter less than we've been led to believe when we've, you know, referenced recycling?
Yeah, I would not get too focused on plastics recycling. I mean, I do recycle plastics that at the bottom it says number one or number two, but nothing else. In the book, The Problem with Plastic, which I wrote with Adam Mahoney, we take a broad policy overview, but we also include practical tips for people, including a checklist to go through your own home, see where your heaviest use of plastic is. I urge people to focus on what they use the most. So, for instance, if you're making coffee every morning with those plastic pods where you have hot water going through the plastic, I would stop that. Never put plastic in the microwave because the toxic chemicals in the plastic can leach into your food or beverage. Avoid black plastic at all costs because that's made from recycled electronic waste. So your old computer or iPhone may be used for black plastic that your takeout food comes in. You know, try to bring reusable containers to restaurants, especially for leftovers. Bring your own mug to coffee shops. All of that makes a difference if enough people do that. But we really need people in the civic arena showing up at a county legislature meeting and saying, here are my three ideas on how we can reduce plastic in Delaware County. Then engage with your state legislators so we can tip the scale and get environmental voices considered more in Albany decision-making. And work with other groups. Don't go it alone. So at Beyond Plastics, we have local groups and affiliates. Damascus Citizens is a wonderful, wonderful organization that led the charge blocking hydrofracking in New York. So find your people, work on it together. And even though this seems like an overwhelming, daunting issue, I have the privilege of watching what is unfolding all over the country on plastics issues. And people are getting wins, and they're having a good time doing it. I know the political arena can seem particularly overwhelming these days, but I'm a big believer in working at the local level and then the state level to affect change.
You've devoted much of your career to protecting public health and the environment. Are you optimistic that the next generation will address this issue and keep moving in the right direction?
I am. I also teach at Bennington College in Vermont, and I talk to young people, and I teach a class online, which is open to community people beyond plastic pollution. So, you know, I'm talking to young people all the time. They get it. The problem is Washington, D.C., and how my former agency, the EPA, has been decimated by the Trump administration. And so it's going to take a very long time to rebuild environmental laws. I listened to an interesting interview yesterday with Eric Holder, the former attorney general during the Obama administration. He spoke at the wonderful Obama Presidential Center opening. And he was asked, will the Department of Justice rebound with so many key staff that have been fired or left? And his response really resonated with me. Eric Holder said they can replace some of the very talented attorneys that were fired. But what's going to take a really long time is restoring the public's trust in the Department of Justice, that they are there to be the people's lawyer. And I think that's the same thing with EPA. I'm the first to admit I loved working during the Obama administration at the EPA because we walked in every day looking to protect clean water, clean air, bring enforcement cases, support cutting edge science. But the public image of the EPA is really diminished because they're in the pockets of corporate polluters. And they're making our air dirtier, our water less safe to drink, more pesticide residue on food. So the federal agencies that have been so hurt, they will get young people working for them. But it's going to take a long time to rebuild those programs. And at EPA, it's pretty urgent because we do not want toxic chemicals in our drinking water. We want fracking regulated. You know, my personal preference is for fracking not to happen, but it is happening all over Pennsylvania, and the state and federal governments are not doing a good job protecting drinking water, reducing air pollution, protecting public health. And so my real worry and what keeps me up at night is while it's going to take years to recover from the Trump administration, and a lot has to do with who replaces President Trump, but the health problems are immediate. They are today. And so we need state governments and local governments to really step up. And I really have not seen that in New York or Pennsylvania.
That's Judith Encke, founder and president of Beyond Plastics and the author of The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. Appointed by President Barack Obama, she served as the EPA's regional administrator overseeing environmental protection efforts across New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and 8 tribal nations. She'll be in conversation with Andrea Bernstein at the Deepwater Literary Festival Sunday at 1:30. In the presentation, in the conversation entitled No Future in Plastic. There's more information at deepwaterfestival.com, and more information about Beyond Plastics at beyondplastics.org. Judith, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I can't wait to visit Narrowsburg for the first time on Sunday.
You'll enjoy it. Thank you. Still to come, we'll hear from the local author and journalist who's opening this year's Deepwater Literary Festival. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, inviting you to ring in the summer and support Radio Catskill at the second annual Lou Beach Community House Summer Jamboree. Join us tomorrow, 5 to 8, for live music from Lolly and the Pops and Patsy Cline tribute group The Recliners, plus cold beer from Catskill Brewery. Tickets $25 at the door, benefiting Radio Catskill. Info at wjffradio.org. The Lou Beach Community House Summer Jamboree, a project of the Beaverkill Valley Land Trust.
This is Radio Catskill. Sullivan County native and award-winning journalist Justine Vanderluyen will kick off the Deepwater Literary Festival with a discussion of her new book, Unreasonable Women. The book draws on 7 years of reporting and thousands of accounts of women in prison to explore the stories of survivors of abuse who were incarcerated after protecting themselves. Vanderluyen is also the author of We Are Not Such Things and the host of the investigative podcast Believe Her, and she's joining us now, just ahead of her opening night appearance tonight at Deepwater. Justine, welcome.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here on Radio Catskill.
Tell us a little bit more about Unreasonable Women, a result of 7 years of reporting and thousands of accounts of women in prison. What drew you to these stories?
I was drawn to these stories by one particular story that actually took place in New York State in Poughkeepsie. It's the story of a woman named Nikki Adamondo, who basically... Really long story, really short. She acted in self-defense against an abusive partner, and she was really severely prosecuted and punished and given 19 years to life in prison for that. I reported that story out. I did a podcast on it called Believe Her, and I was just fascinated about what I had seen go down in that particular case, and I wanted to know how common it was across America in our women's prisons everywhere.
A central theme of the book is that courts often focus on a single act without reckoning with the years that led up to it. Talk a little bit about the importance of that distinction.
I think that what we see in the work that I've done on what I'll call it criminalized survival. So it's when a person, and that's usually a woman or a girl, is punished for taking an action to protect herself from or to protect a loved one from physical or sexual violence. And I think what I've seen in my reporting over the past 8 years and what I've seen in the data that I collected for this book is that essentially the system for women in prison, largely, it is extremely common, if not almost 100% of these women have been failed by the system on the one hand. And then that very same system comes around and turns around and very vigorously prosecutes them once they have been pushed into circumstances that very desperate circumstances where they often had no real good choice to make.
Were there any misconceptions about survivors of abuse or incarcerated women that your reporting challenged?
I would say that, you know, in the space that I'm working in, people really know about this. And in these spaces on, you know, feminist law and on women in prison. But I would say that my reporting outside of those spaces really does just upend the general idea that we have that our women's prisons are filled with women who are a danger to society. I kind of say many of these women, a society was a danger to them. And I think that I hopefully am successful in the reporting, really looking at these lives very deeply. And when you look at people's stories in their shoes and you can really draw them out, you can see all the myths about domestic violence and, you know, why didn't she leave and the police will keep you safe. You can see those myths really demolished through these stories of these women that I reported out.
You've described this as a work of literary reportage with the pace of a crime novel. How did you approach telling these deeply reported stories in a way that keeps readers engaged?
So the book I sent letters to 10,000 women on murder and manslaughter charges, 10,000 women in prison on murder and manslaughter charges across America. And I received over 1,000 letters back. And I interweave the original data from those letters into the book, as well as a lot of words from various women in different states, survivors. But I deeply reported on three women, and I just got to know those women extremely well over, you know, 7 years reporting. And not just got to know them well, but their stories, the documentation behind it, the enormous case files. And so I really tried to
They're very remarkable women, these three women, really interesting, sort of extraordinary stories. And I just tried to go as deeply into their experience and try to put that through for the reader. But I also was very aware that the material is quite tough material. And so I really wanted to make it not an eat your vegetables book or anything that was hard to plod through, but I was very aware of making it like a fast, quick sort of in the tradition of the best true crime, a story that you could really want to get through, since it is so hard to, some of it is so hard and traumatic that they've gone through. I just wanted the reading itself to be, in a way, easy.
As I said, you're opening this year's Deepwater Literary Festival tonight at 5 in Narrowsburg at the Krauss Recital Hall. It's a free event. You're in conversation with journalist Nina Burley as well there. What do you hope audiences are taking away from this discussion tonight?
Well, I don't know what Nina's going to ask, but she is a brilliant reporter, and I'm really honored that she's read the book and she's going to speak to me. I hope that they perhaps learn something from the talk, but I just hope that they have a great time and maybe, you know, want to go to more Deepwater Festival events, because it's such a great thing in our area. So I just hope people enjoy themselves. That's really, and get some knowledge while they're at it.
Justine Vanderluyen is an award-winning journalist and author who lives locally. Her new book, Unreasonable Women, has just been published. There's more information about Justine at justinevdl.com. And again, she's opening the Deepwater Literary Festival with a conversation with journalist Nina Burley called The Past on Trial tonight at 5 at Krauss Recital Hall in Narrowsburg, New York. Justine, we'll let you go so you can get ready, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tim. Bye.
And before we go, we can tell you about a Juneteenth Pride crossover event that's coming to Newburgh tonight, celebrating the intersection of Black, queer, and trans identity. The New York Public News Network's Elias Guerra has more.
The Freedom Ball will be hosted by Hudson Valley-based media company Community Humanity Art Representation Media, or CHARM. The organization's founder, Sabrina Key, said the event honors the origins of drag and ballroom culture and the central role of Black, queer, and trans people. Those include William Dorsey Swan, a formerly enslaved Black man from D.C. who called himself the first drag queen back in the 1880s, and Crystal LaBeija, a Black trans woman credited with reinventing ball culture and creating the system to care for homeless queer and trans people.
The mothers and the fathers of these houses took care of folks who were unhoused, took care of folks who were sex workers, took care of folks who, you know, were incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. A lot of these folks, you know, did not make it to their elder years.
Key said Friday's festivities will include a variety of performances, including categories such as Afrofuturism and Revolutionary Runway. They said ballroom is about self-determination.
The realness category, which is basically like, you have to look real so you don't get clocked. The whole premise of that is like, who in this ballroom house can go out and get groceries for the family and not get clocked and not be harmed and not be targeted?
The Freedom Ball, which will take place at High Point Newburgh at 8 p.m., will be free to all Black people with a sliding scale entry fee for everyone else. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
And that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Happy Juneteenth. Happy Pride. Have a good weekend.
Support comes from Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor, offering exhibitions, performances, screenings, and more, with long-term installations from James Turrell and Saul LeWitt. Open year-round. CatskillArtSpace.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's a live event from the sunny climes of Tampa, Florida. From citrus to seafood, Spanish flavors, and Southern charm, we're learning about what makes the food of South Florida so unique. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather breezy at times with a high of 75 and partly sunny skies. Clear and breezy this evening at a low of 55. For the weekend, Saturday 72, sunny and pleasant. mainly clear. Saturday night, low 52. And for Sunday, sunshine and clouds mixed, high 75. A little cooler Monday with a high of 66 and some rain expected. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.